stars are perfect. Not us. Not us. We are here to ruin ourselves and to break our hearts and love the wrong people and die. I mean that the storybooks are bullshit. Now I want you to come upstairs with me and get in my bed.
A woman gets engaged, then falls in love with her fiancé's brother. Awkward. This week, special guest Courtney Noah joins us to discuss a new slogan for Cheetos, heat-resistant prosthetic hands, and what Bugs Bunny can teach you about opera. Then we turn back time. Get it? Cher? To find out if Moonstruck stands the test of time.
Time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glut. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of the Test of Time podcast. My name is Alan Noah, and I'm joined here by our very special guest, Courtney Noah. Hello, honey.
Hello, everyone.
And I still have a co-host, too, who's sitting there on my computer waiting patiently. Hi, James.
Hey, Alan. Hey, Courtney.
How's it going there? How you doing in quarantine?
I'm doing well. It's the last time we recorded a movie together. All three of us were together. Actually, I don't think we were recording. I think I saw your sister at your house when we recorded Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
Right.
And I saw Courtney, but that was not. We did not record an episode that night together.
Right. No, the last episode that you were on, Courtney, was the very romantic movie Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, for Valentine's Day.
Yes. And today we're going to talk about Moonstruck. But before we get into Moonstruck, I thought we should take a minute and just talk about the movies that we've been watching during quarantine. Because Courtney and I, we've seen some good ones. And I thought we could like swap recommendations. Obviously, I'm not talking about movies that we've talked about in the podcast, like Jaws and the Robin Hood movies and things like that, which obviously we watched. But James, have you seen any good movies over the past couple months?
You know, I have seen a number of movies that were like dumb, but entertaining. Like I could just kill some time with them, but I haven't seen any fantastic films. There's even some good television series, but I haven't seen any really good films. How about you?
I think we've seen some good ones. I don't know. What's like been your favorite so far, Courtney?
Well, I mean, during quarantine, I'm kind of looking for something not so heavy or disturbing in any way. So I would say it's not a new one, but we saw Brittany Runs a Marathon. And it was actually the second time I've seen that movie. I was rewatching it because you didn't see it the first time. That's a pretty good one if you're looking for kind of a light, inspirational, funny, kind of quirky movie.
Yeah, I like that one a lot. That was really simple and funny, but like sweet too.
Yeah, definitely sweet.
Yeah, I think you'd like that, James. That's on Amazon Prime.
You know, there's a couple in the same idea that Courtney's talking about, this idea of I just don't want to think too much about some of these films to pass the time. I do have a couple really not thinking about it action films that I'm looking forward to seeing. They might be guilty pleasures, but I am looking forward to seeing Rambo: Last Blood that came out on Amazon. And also, this series is incredibly mindless, but I've seen the first two and they're just stupidly entertaining. The Angel Has Fallen, you know, the Gerard Butler series.
Right.
There's a third one. And I don't see these things in the theater, but there's a third one. So that's the kind of thing I might watch at like 12 at night.
What has fallen in the third movie? It was London Has Fallen was one of them, right?
I think he has fallen. Like, I think he's now framed for something. And yeah, exactly.
Is the sequel to He Has Fallen, He Is Risen?
No, but it is Gerard Butler. He hasn't been in much since 300. Have you seen him anything since 300?
No, I don't think I have. I think the best movie that we watched during quarantine was Parasite, which is an easy choice because it won Best Picture, but that's really, really good. And that was overhyped to me a lot and could have been not as good because of the hype, but I think that one's really definitely worth watching. That was on Hulu, and really, it's worth 2 hours.
I forgot I did see Parasite like the first week of quarantine. It was a totally different film than I thought it was every half hour. I thought it was this kind of film. Then I thought it was this kind of film. Okay, I figured it out. It is, oh, no, wait, who's that guy? I just thought it was very intriguing.
Yes, definitely.
But I'm humble enough to admit I didn't really understand maybe the absolute groundbreakingness of it. It's one of those things I understand that's technically directed very well, and I thought it was entertaining. And I think movies like this, maybe it loses something in a translation, just reading subtitles. But I thought it was very good.
I would agree with that. I thought it was very good, too. I thought maybe the overhype had gotten to me, and I was like, I don't know. It was entertaining, but was it worth all the hype?
See, when we watched Knives Out, was it maybe a week or two ago? I really enjoyed Knives Out, but I thought that was so overhyped that it was pretty damn good, but like wasn't as amazing as I had heard about for so long. Like, I still recommend it and I still enjoyed it, but yeah, I don't know. For me, Parasite just kind of lived up to that hyperbole, in my humble opinion.
It doesn't technically count because I saw it about a week or two before quarantine, but I also saw a fantastic Korean film called Train to Busan. And if you like zombie films, it's a fantastic film, and it's on Netflix. Korean film, very good. Train to Busan, Busan.
All right, good to know. Next time we need a Korean zombie on a train movie. But let's talk about Moonstruck, which is the movie we're going to be talking about today. And Courtney, you kind of just brought it up out of the blue the other night. We were having dinner, and out of nowhere, you were like, I want to come on the podcast to talk about Moonstruck. And I was like, well, okay, sure. But what made you want to watch this movie?
Were we having Italian food? We've been having a lot of Italian meals. Like, our Sunday evening meal is typically some type of Italian home-cooked meal.
Okay,
and that was what put on it? Some Italian music, and I think I'm like, oh, remember that movie Moonstruck? It's been so long.
Okay, it was the food connection.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. I don't think we were listening to Cher at the time.
No, it definitely wasn't Cher. I think it was more the Italian restaurant music playlist.
Okay, fair enough. Courtney, when did you first see this movie? Like, when were you first exposed to it? I'm guessing you didn't see it in the theater in 1987 or 1988.
No, probably saw it at some point when it came out on VHS, I'm sure, at the local video store. It was 87. Maybe I saw it when I was like 10 or 11.
Okay. Well, I had never seen this movie before. James, had you seen it?
I had never seen this film. I, of course, had heard of it. However, I'm going to admit, when you first said Moonstruck, I was like, oh, I always wanted to kind of see that Bruce Willis thing where he came from. Wasn't it Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd? And then I realized that's Moonlighting. Yeah, I never saw that. That's a television show, right?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, I never saw that either. But no, I did know because I knew that, I guess it's, I'd almost say iconic, a poster of Cher, kind of with her arms in the air. And did you know one fact about this film, the same as I did from The Simpsons?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
This is an episode that airs in like 1995, let's say. Kent Brockman says, meet the man who's just woken up from a coma from over 20 years. And he goes, do Sonny and Cher still have that stupid show? And Kent Brockman says, no. In fact, she won an Oscar and he is a congressman. And he just like dies of a heart attack. Sonny Bono, I did know, was a congressman, but I knew Cher won an Oscar, and I knew it was from this film. That's pretty much all I knew about this film, that it won an Oscar.
I think she has she won other Oscars besides this movie?
I don't know, or maybe a Mask, I want to say.
I'm not sure. Hold on, I'm looking her up to see if she has... No, she's only won one Oscar. Okay, I guess you're right. It was from this movie.
Yeah, you know, just like you, I'd never seen this film before. This film is about Loretta Castorini, played by Cher, and she's a widowed bookkeeper from Brooklyn, and she gets engaged to her boyfriend Johnny, played by Danny Aiello. After proposing, Johnny asks Loretta to invite his estranged brother Ronnie, played by Nicolas Cage, to their wedding. And then suddenly, Johnny flies to Italy to be with his sick mother. Johnny's brother Ronnie is everything that Johnny isn't, and he falls for Loretta. And while Loretta is torn between the two brothers, her father is also having a secret affair. Everyone's acting crazy because of the Bella Luna, the beautiful moon, and in the end, all the characters need to decide who they truly want to be with.
So this movie was an Oscar darling. Cher won an Oscar for it. I think it was nominated for a few others as well. Was it a big box office hit when it came out?
Yeah, this film had a very modest budget. It was made for $15 million, and it was released limited release on December 18th, 1987. It opened like with $187,000 on its first screening, but it wound up on its $15 million budget, grossing $80 million domestically.
Wow.
So, you know, it was a big hit, and certainly all the awards and all the acclaim that came from it certainly helped.
Apparently, the director was pretty confident this was going to be a hit and do really well at the Oscars. But the actors in the movie did not. Olympia Dukakis and Cher both thought that it was just going to be a sleeper type movie, not a lot of attention, etc.
Yeah, and the director that you're talking about, the director is Norman Jewison. He's a very famous director. He's directed films like In the Heat of the Night, Fiddler on the Roof. And, you know, speaking of Fiddler on the Roof and his name being Norman Jewison, he is not Jewish, by the way. He is a Protestant. So
really?
Yeah.
And the movie starts with Johnny and Loretta, and they're on a date, and Johnny's very nervous, and he ultimately decides to propose to Loretta, but he does it all wrong. He doesn't get down on one knee, and Loretta tells him that he has to get down on his knees. He's on both knees, which is also wrong. He doesn't have a ring for her, and he seems like genuinely like stupefied that he was like, oh, right, the ring. Like, he called the person at the restaurant to tell them that he was going to propose because the waiter Bobo was like, oh, he's going to propose soon. He called me to work it out with me. But he really didn't make any specific arrangements. Like, this is textbook how not to propose.
Well, I mean, you get the feeling that this is not two young lovers that are just so happy to spend their life together. These are both people that, as you learn, are kind of, you know, settling. There's no chemistry between these two people. I love this Italian restaurant. It's got this fantastic painting of Italy. It has what I can only assume is an erupting Mount Vesuvius in the background.
I miss that. I'll have to check it out next time.
Yeah, I totally miss that.
Something about this film is that there's a fantastic, very famous cast in this film, a relatively younger Danny Aiello, because I first saw him, I guess, in Do the Right Thing. Cher, I never really knew 80s Cher. I've seen pictures of, you know, Sonny and Cher, and then I knew her from, like, Believe, late 90s Cher. There's John Mahoney. People might know him best as the dad from Frasier.
Or Say Anything.
Yeah, he's been in a lot of stuff.
And speaking of John Mahoney, that character is on a date in this restaurant, and he's with this younger woman who gets up and throws a glass of water at him. And that's pretty much all we see of that character for a good, I don't know, hour or so into the movie. But then right after proposing, Johnny is on his way to JFK because he needs to catch a flight to Italy to see his dying mother. And the running gag is basically that everyone kind of wants her to die. That seems to be the joke, at least from Loretta's point of view. And then she goes home and is talking to her mom, Rose, who's played by Olympia Dukakis. And they seem to just kind of think that life will be better once the mother is dead. I don't really get that. Is that like a meddling thing? Like, they don't want her to meddle?
I'll say this movie is an hour and 42 minutes long, and it took me about an hour and 49 minutes because there were several parts I rewound, probably like three parts I rewound, because sort of like you, I was wondering, is this a joke? I did kind of wonder, did I miss something there? As Danny Aiello takes off in an airplane, there's this old lady that speaks to Loretta, and she says, I'm putting a curse on this plane. And I'm telling you, I really thought this film was going to go in another direction, that the plane was going to blow up. And like, I wasn't quite sure what was going on here.
That was another thing that I was reading about with some of the critics, that they were saying, even though it's billed as a romance, it really is more of a comedy. So I think you're right in the perception that it's supposed to be funny, although not in our traditional sense of what we think of as outright funny comedies.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of jokes that don't really work, and then there are things that seem funny when they're not supposed to be. I think that's going to be a recurring theme throughout this episode of the podcast. One of the jokes that I thought was genuinely funny is when Johnny is calling from Italy and he calls to New York. He calls to Loretta. He says into the phone, Loretta, I'm calling from my mother's deathbed. And Loretta says, oh, how was the flight? And he goes, oh, it was okay. The waitresses were nice. And then they get into the conversation about the dying mother. I thought that was kind of funny. He's at his mother's deathbed. There's no how was the flight.
This was another scene that I didn't understand, because I was like, did she not mention once, like, how's your mother, your dying mother? Did I miss something here? But wasn't it very odd? All Cher wants to know is, did you tell her we're going to get married and is she dead yet? You know, it's very weird.
Well, yeah, it is weird. I mean, another very weird part is the fact that as Johnny is leaving for Italy in the first place, he gives Loretta this job and says, I want you to call my brother Ronnie. Why do their names rhyme? Because I don't know, but it's stupid. But he says, I want you to call my brother Ronnie. We haven't spoken in 5 years. Invite him to the wedding. And if he hasn't spoken to his brother, now would be a pretty good time for him to call his brother, because A, he's getting married, and B, their mother is dying. So it just seems like he should really pick up the phone himself and call his estranged brother, but he doesn't. He puts it all on Loretta, which is very, very bizarre. And she goes and seeks out this brother because she calls him and he hangs up on her. But the brother is Nicolas Cage, who is so young and I guess supposed to be super hot. I mean, when you first saw this movie, Courtney, were you like into this guy?
I don't know if I was looking at him like that, but I think definitely they're trying to portray him in that way, with the sweaty wife beater with the muscles, for sure.
Yeah. Apparently that bakery that they filmed that scene in, it was one of the last bakeries in Manhattan that had that kind of oven. So that was why they filmed there. But apparently it was really hot and sweaty down there. So that's real, I guess.
Lovely. Sweat on your fresh baked bread.
Yeah, right?
That's all I could think. Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do love a Nicolas Cage playing, you know, a level 10 Nicolas Cage role. And we don't know much about him. He was kind of introduced very mysteriously as this guy shoveling coal into a furnace. And I mean, this is like your old school alpha male. I mean, the closest thing in the urban equivalent of like a coal miner. I mean, this guy is, he's a little nutty. And the moment he hears that his brother is getting married again, he just yells, Chrissy, bring me the big knife so I can cut my own throat. And some lady, who you assume is Chrissy, is like, I'm not bringing you the knife.
And then he goes into this whole spiel about why he's fighting with his brother. And the reason is that his brother asked for a loaf of bread, and then Ronnie was distracted and he sliced off his fingers in like the bread slicer. And he blames his brother for that. And the first thing Loretta says is, well, that's not his fault. It was an accident. And then Ronnie's like, what am I, like the arbiter of justice or something like that? I forget the exact line. But it's like, this is a stupid reason for you to be angry at your brother. And the way he's screaming about his hand, I legitimately wasn't sure if this scene was supposed to be funny. Getting back to what we were talking about of like, when is this movie a comedy and when is it not? I kind of thought maybe this was satire and I was supposed to laugh, but it's not really funny. It's just funny because Nicolas Cage is overacting so hard.
It's like funny, uncomfortable, kind of, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, obviously a man losing his fingers in a horrible accident isn't funny. And
him, and yet you laughed pretty hard at that scene.
Well, because I'm laughing not at him, but at Nicolas Cage. I feel like Nicolas Cage trying to be serious and dramatic is funny, even though I don't think it's supposed to be.
One thing that I was wondering about was with his hand. So he has like wooden fingers. I was like, is that what they did in the late 80s? I don't know. James the doctor, like, do you get wooden fingers when your hand falls off? I would think they're starting to do prosthetics at that point, right?
Like something better than just wood.
Yeah, exactly.
I did not take in medical school the, I'm sure there might have been an elective history of prosthetics, 1800 to present, but it looked a little weird. It kind of looked pretty ancient. Like, I would guess that they would have something better than that. And also a wooden hand in some kind of factory is not, by an oven is not the best idea.
Right. I mean, I guess obviously you wouldn't want metal. That would conduct heat and plastic would melt. But yeah, if you're working by fire, I don't know what kind of prosthetic hand you would want. Gold? Like in Game of Thrones? Like a Jamie Lannister hand?
Oh, yeah, but that's pretty awesome.
But this guy's a little too blue collar for that. We haven't talked about Loretta's father at all, this guy Cosmo. James, did you recognize this actor? Because I thought he looked familiar and Courtney told me what I know him from. Did you happen to know?
No. Where is he from?
One of my favorite movies, Little Shop of Horrors. He's Mr.
Mushnick.
Mushnick, yes.
I haven't seen that film in 30 years, so that would be a good one to review again.
Oh, we're definitely going to do that movie on the podcast. I think there's a remake or a reboot or something that they've announced. Hmm. I mean, all movie production is halted, but when the new one comes out, we could definitely revisit that one.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's a classic. But yeah, it's Mr. Mushnick who plays Cosmo the plumber. And at first, it seems like a kind of joke. Rose is saying something about, oh, he's going to listen to some music and then he'll come to bed and he won't touch me. And it's kind of a throwaway line. I thought it was just a joke of like, oh, they're an old married couple and they don't have sex. And she's like, oh, I wish we could have sex. But it's actually more than that, because the reason he's not touching his wife is that he's having an affair with this woman named Mona.
Yeah, yeah. I like this guy Cosmo when I first meet him, certainly. He's this kind of curmudgeon-y old man. When Loretta first tells her dad, I'm getting married, he goes, you're getting married again? It didn't work out so well the last time. And she goes, Dad, he died. And I love the introduction of him as a character. He is a plumber by trade. And there's this great scene where you got this young yuppie couple and they're trying to pick out pipes. And you can tell this guy, he does not know what a wrench is. Cosmo knows, and he says, he quotes him like $11,000 for the pipes. And I don't know if that's a good price or not. It's certainly $1987 dollars. But he has such a convincing reason why it's $11,000 that I was like, yeah, yeah, they don't pay the man 11 grand. He's a good talker. I really like that scene.
Right. And there is a bit of a gag about their home, which at first I thought was in Manhattan and I was confused, but it's not. It's in Brooklyn. They own like this huge brownstone apartment. And there's a joke later of like, how do you have this, such an amazing home? And the answer is, oh, because he's a plumber. So that's how they're able to afford this beautiful mansion in Brooklyn, because he's charging $11,000 for copper pipes.
Yeah, and this is kind of the Italian tradition. The older generation, people are living with the family for much longer in their lifetime. And this is kind of one of those, they just had to have a big house. And Brooklyn in the 80s, like, we didn't talk about it, but the opening credits of this film is one of those, like, this is New York of the 80s. This is not your glamorous, like, you know, Carrie Bradshaw, Sex and the City kind of Manhattan. There's a lot of delivery trucks in the opening credits. And they do show the Metropolitan Opera.
Well, the whole opening credits is following this delivery truck bringing stuff to the Met, which is a very weird opening credit sequence, I thought. So after Loretta talks to Ronnie at the bakery and, you know, he's screaming about killing himself, she says, please, let's go somewhere and talk in private. They go up to his apartment. He lives above the bakery. And they have this whole conversation where Loretta basically says, you complain about your hand, you blame your brother, but it's not his fault. You are a wolf. And you knew that the relationship you were in before was bad because he was engaged to be married and then his fiance left him after he maimed his hand. And she's saying, you did it on purpose. You're a wolf who can chew off his own foot. Except every time she says wolf, it sounds like woof, like W-O-O-F, like she was making, you know, like a dog sound, like the dog says woof. I couldn't get past that. I was really distracted by the way she pronounced that.
I didn't even get where the whole story came from. I was like, how is she making this conclusion about him? Someone she just met, who's clearly dramatic, but what? Like,
yeah, she's definitely projecting a lot. She has filled in his entire life story. Yeah, after they've talked for about 2 minutes. There's a lot of that in this movie. I mean, in two or three scenes, he's going to declare his undying love for her. Ronnie says that he's in love with Loretta literally the next morning. They spent one night together and he declares that he loves her. So there is a lot of that. Wait, how did that happen? The wolf thing is kind of hinted at earlier in the movie when she picks up the champagne on her way home and there's like the shopkeeper and his wife in the liquor store. And she's saying, oh, the way you look at her, I don't like the way you look at her. You look at her like a wolf. So they sort of establish that theme, but like how it applies to Ronnie and chewing his arm off.
But again, is she just projecting that conversation that she overheard into this random guy that she just met? 2 minutes ago?
I guess so. It's very bizarre.
I kind of saw it as one of the themes of the film that comes in and out, the whole moon thing. Later, you're going to see the father-in-law. He kind of howls at the moon with the dogs. I thought it was one of these wolves howl at the moon things. But this does have one of those scenes that you may not really see much anymore. It's got one of these scenes where the man and woman, they're screaming back and forth. And then the man just grabs the woman, kisses her. And there's a pause. And then she goes, oh, yeah, that's great. Let's keep making out. I don't think you're going to see much of those things anymore.
I get what you're saying. I mean, it's definitely meant to be like sexy aggressive, the way he like flips over the table and grabs her in his arms, but it's weird. And the way she reacts to it is also weird, where he's like, I'm going to take you to bed. And she's like, yes, take me to bed. And he's doing it because he's mad at his brother, and she's also going along with it because she seems to be angry at Johnny too. She says, leave nothing for him to marry. Like, that's a weird line. That, like, kind of sounded like something out of the 50 Shades of Grey movie, I thought, where all of the dialogue was terrible.
Maybe. Again, very dramatic. I guess that's what they're meant for each other.
I guess so.
I wouldn't say it's terrible dialogue. I just think it's horrible. It's his brother, you know? Like, it's kind of horrible.
Yes.
But I wouldn't say it's horrible dialogue, as in, like, it's actually, you know, cool as ice dialogue.
I think it's pretty horrible dialogue, too. I get what you're saying, but I think it's also just bad writing. But getting back to the moon motif, everyone's having dinner without Loretta because she's spending the night with Ronnie. And it's Cosmo and Rose and her brother and sister-in-law. And they have this whole conversation about the moon. And the uncle goes on and on about this big moon. And what the old man, the grandfather, had been saying is that this is the Bella Luna and it brings the woman to the man. And so I guess the idea is that all of these characters are acting crazy because of the moon. Loretta is attracted to her fiancé's brother because of the moon. And they're all moonstruck, even though they don't actually say moonstruck in the movie, moonstruck. The next morning, Loretta, I guess, finally does come to her senses. And she slaps Ronnie, not once, but twice, when he says that he loves her. I remember that line from the trailer, the snap out of it.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a classic scene.
Yeah. You know, we've been married almost 13 years. You've never slapped me across the face. So thank you.
Would you like me to?
No, I would not. You're strong. I do not want you to. James, have you ever gotten slapped across the face by a girl? A woman?
No, I have not.
Really? I find that very surprising.
What you find it surprising that I have not done something where a woman in a restaurant, you're surprised that what happened to John Mahoney did not happen to me?
I'm just saying I would have expected it to happen at least once.
I've always wanted to see someone get, have we ever? I don't think we have seen anyone get water or drink thrown at them.
I don't think so. I don't know if that happens very often of like throwing the drink across the table, but I guess it's bound to happen sometimes, right?
Yeah.
But Ronnie's whole thing with Loretta is that she says, I can't see you again. You can't come to the wedding. Forget that this ever happened. But he says, I love two things. I love the opera and you. So you need to come to the opera with me and then I'll let you go. And again, like, wait, he loves her? How? Why? Where does that come from? Also, it's a little bit weird that he loves the opera just because he's like this muscular guy who is tough, and I guess tough guys can like the opera too, but I thought that was a little surprising.
You know, I'm actually going to quote Richard Gere's character from Pretty Woman. And when he brings Vivian to the opera, he explains to her, you either love opera or you don't. And you'll know it the first time you see it. If you don't fall in love with it, you could learn to appreciate it. I think he says, but it will never move your soul or something like that. People either go insane for opera or they don't. So I could see even a tough guy, especially an Italian guy like this, that probably has a lot of the old country back in his upbringing, probably listened to records of opera, you know, from grandma's house and stuff. I have a feeling this guy's exposed to it. He doesn't go often.
But does he have tickets for that night just ready? Or is he just confident he'll be able to get tickets like at the box office from a scalper?
That is unclear.
This is not an important plot point, but it is questionable when you think about it. I do like when he says to Loretta to meet him at the Met and she goes, where's the Met? Which, yeah, fine. Maybe she's never been to the Met. But if she's a New Yorker, she should know where it is, or also just be confident that she can get into a taxi cab and say, take me to the Met, and the taxi driver will take her to the Met.
I think it's more certainly the second one, because I don't think everyone knows where the Met Opera is. And also they might confuse it with the Met, which is also known as the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is a completely different place on the other side of the city from Lincoln Center's opera, which is where this film takes place. On the Upper West Side.
Fair enough. Have you ever seen an opera at the Met, James?
I did, actually. Yes, I did.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I thought it was actually very pretty. I thought everything was, it was quite beautiful. It was something I saw, and I was happy to see it, and I don't think I needed to see it again.
So Loretta agrees to go to the opera and she has like an impromptu makeover. She goes to a salon and gets all of the gray out of her hair and she gets a new dress. When she's like trying on the dress, it's a really weird scene. Like the music.
Yeah, we were talking about this. The fact that she like undresses and tries on clothes in her living room. And I'm like, isn't this the same living room that like her parents could just walk into at any moment? But she's having like a little moment with the fire and everything and a glass of wine.
Yeah. That's not how you get dressed when we're going on a date, I don't think.
No, it was definitely, it seemed like a night at home. Like she was having a night at home, but like, oh no, she still has to go and have this date later on.
Yeah, and the music was very softcore porn-esque. It really seemed like something you would see like late night on Cinemax. Just like the music.
Oh, it was a sax solo.
Yeah, that was a very, very bizarre scene. Also 50 Shades of Grey-esque. Just in terms
you're
of
really
like,
trying to plug the connections here with that.
I guess. Well, if I make another one, I could say it in the beginning of the episode. How this movie's like 50 Shades of Grey. Oh, now we've ruined it. But Loretta eventually goes to the opera with Ronnie And Cosmo is also there with his side piece, I guess, Mona. And they bump into each other. And the deal that they come to is, well, I won't say anything if you don't say anything.
Yeah, and La Boheme, like a lot of operas, kind of has a sad ending. I believe it's a tragic love story. I've not seen it. Have you seen La Boheme, Al? Courtney?
I haven't.
No.
I first learned about opera, I don't know about you, but from Bugs Bunny. I don't know if you remember those old ones. And Bugs Bunny, he ends his opera by saying, oh, what'd you expect from an opera? Happy ending? And that's when I learned, oh, I guess all operas end sad. So it's kind of a sad part of the story because they all kind of are dejected because the dad sees that his daughter saw he's cheating on his mom. And he also sees that Loretta's with a woman that's not her fiancé. You know, it's not a good time for the family.
And while the four of them are at the opera, Rose goes to the Italian restaurant that they go to, which, by the way, on the window, it says Italian Ristorante, which to me is stupid. It should either be Italian restaurant or Ristorante Italiano, but not Italian Ristorante.
Hmm.
Is a small detail, I know, but I thought that was a little bit weird. But Perry, the John Mahoney character, is there. And once again, he's with another much younger woman who he offends. She throws water on him. And then he's alone and Rose is alone. And she invites him to have dinner with her. And they talk about love and relationships.
And at this point, Rose knows about the affair. So she's at this restaurant alone. And I totally think they're going to have an affair because she kind of feels like she's earned it. And if he does it, I can do it. And she asks this question. She asks, why do men chase women? And Perry has all these answers. And he talks about how he just cycles through these students. They're naive, like, you know, 20-year-olds. He's this wise professor who just, he says, I just throw some, like, you know, age-old wisdom at them. But every few months into it, they all figure out, I don't have anything real to offer them. And he just cycles through them. So he doesn't have anything to offer, except he says, maybe we chase women because men fear dying.
Is that true, James? Courtney and I are old and married, but you're single. So, I mean, is that true? Is that why you chase women?
Chase women? well, why do I date women? Well, I'll see. When a boy and a girl, sometimes a boy and a boy or a girl and a girl, or there's so many combinations, Al. And yeah, we'll have this conversation on a different podcast.
Okay. But I mean, the way that Perry is describing how he cycles through these women, it really felt predatory. The way he's using his classroom as like a place to meet girls for him to date, like horrifically inappropriate.
I mean, I think certainly you can see that from today's point of view. That's how I took it. I might be wrong, but I was trying to see it through an 87 lens. It was probably like frowned upon, but not really that bad to date students when you're a teacher. But he definitely is kind of this loser. And he says like the only thing charming about himself is that they don't know that I'm a loser yet. And they always figure it out a couple months into it. And he even realizes that Rose is too classy for him because he walks her home and gets to her home and he's like, can I come in? She's like, nah. And he's like, yeah, okay, fine. Like he doesn't really try that much. He can't get her like the way he could get like one of his grad students.
I mean, it is interesting that he at least tries to hook up with her. And I think the reason is that he's been with all of these younger girls that he can't connect to. And now he has this one conversation with someone who's on his level and he is attracted to her. And that's like his arc in two scenes, I guess. But to me, it was a little bit weird that he normally dates 19-year-old college students, and now he's hitting on Olympia Dukakis, who's wearing a babushka. I mean, that is what she's wearing, right? The babushka, like the headscarf. I think that's a babushka.
Maybe, but it's Olympia Dukakis. She's a very attractive woman. When he finally sees a woman his age, Olympia Dukakis, that's not a bad choice. When you see her in that Italian restaurant dressed up nicely.
I think he just liked that she saw him for who he was. He wasn't hiding, right?
Right. Yeah, I get that. But so after the opera, Ronnie is trying to get Loretta back into his bed. I mean, he uses that phrase a lot, come into my bed. This monologue here was also really powerfully cheesy. I mean, he's talking about what?
Powerfully cheesy. I love that phrase.
I mean, it is.
I see exactly what you mean by that.
I mean, I guess it could be like a slogan for like Cheetos or Cheez-Its or something, or the Nicolas Cage acting in this movie. I mean, I wrote down a couple of the lines that I stole from IMDb. The past and the future is a joke to me now. I see that they're nothing. And then he says, the snowflakes are perfect. The stars are perfect. Not us. Not us. I mean, it's really, really lame. It's supposed to be mirroring what happens in the opera. We see that moment in La Boheme earlier where the man and the woman, they reach out their hands and she takes his hand in the snow. And that's what happens between Ronnie and Loretta here. Okay, I get it. But she, after saying that she wasn't going to go in with him, she gives in, she succumbs, she goes in into his apartment. They spend another night together. And meanwhile, Johnny comes home from Italy.
Yeah, and his mom has recovered.
It's a miracle.
Everything's a miracle in this movie.
He returns in a New York City cab, and I had to freeze frame it. I noticed it was $1.10 for the surcharge and then a dime for every ninth of a mile. I don't know what it is now, but you could probably go pretty far, like, you know, for a couple bucks then. And he gets to Loretta's house, but Loretta's out because she's out with Ronnie, but he doesn't know that yet.
Right. And basically everything comes to a head the next morning at breakfast when Rose tells Cosmo to stop seeing the other woman. And he like gets up, he punches the table and then says, okay, which I guess is like not the worst way that conversation could have gone.
Yeah, I don't know if the slapping the table at first, I think you think it's because he's mad, but is it that, or is he just saying it's final? I think it's more like a statement, like, it's done.
Oh, okay, that's fair. I guess I interpret it as, damn it, I got caught. I should be really mad, but she asked it in such a reasonable way. I'm just going to say, okay. Like all of the fighting and the anger was in that one punch down. It could be just, you know, him being definitive about it.
Yeah, either way.
And then someone knocks on the door and they think it's Johnny, but it's Ronnie. And he wants to profess his love for Loretta some more because he hasn't done it enough, I guess. The aunt and the uncle show up and they think that maybe Loretta stole from them because she was apparently supposed to make a deposit, which she didn't make. But no, that's not it. Finally, Johnny comes and Loretta's ready to break it off with him, except he breaks it off with her because he thinks that if they get married, his mother will die, which doesn't make a ton of sense, but all right, fine. And Loretta's kind of mad that Johnny's breaking up with her, even though she wants to break up with him. But Johnny calls off the engagement. And then immediately Ronnie picks up the ring and is like, okay, will you marry me instead, Loretta? And, you know, Johnny doesn't know that his brother's been sleeping with Loretta. And it's kind of shocking and confusing all around. The old man even says, I'm confused. But Loretta agrees to marry Ronnie. And that's the happy ending for the movie.
That's amore.
Indeed.
Which is the opening credits song we didn't mention.
Right. Dean Martin. And the closing credits.
And the closing, yeah.
Yeah. So, Courtney, our very special guest, and my amore.
Aw.
Thank you. Do you think that Moonstruck stands the test of time?
You know, I'm struggling with this one because at first I would have said no. But then, you know, I think the characters within the movie are all pretty timeless. And I think they're interesting in and of themselves. Can I go in between?
No, you got it. No, you got to give a yes or a no.
All right, I'll go with yes, because I think the characters do have that kind of timeless sense that, you know, just all families have their issues and you know, you just have to accept people for who they are and find your true love.
So who are we? I mean, I don't want to be any of these characters, to be honest.
What about the older couple that's totally fine?
We could be them.
The aunt and the uncle?
Yeah.
We didn't really talk about that much.
Okay, I'm okay to be the aunt and the uncle, sure.
Yeah, he's kind of quirky.
Goofy.
Goofy, yeah, yeah. That's you, for sure.
Okay, fine. As long as I don't
and
have to
like,
be...
she's like, what are you talking about, crazy old man?
Yeah, okay, I'm all right with that. As long as I don't have to be Ronnie or Johnny or Cosmo, I'm okay with that. Or I guess it could be like the old man who likes the dogs.
Oh, the grandpa. Yeah, I said he was one of my favorite characters. I like him.
Just yeah.
Doing his thing.
Yeah. And I like at the very end when he's very upset about the fact that Cosmo says he won't pay for Loretta's wedding. And then at the very end of the movie, he finally says, my son, you must pay for her wedding. It is your obligation. And Cosmo's like, okay, if she gets married, I'll pay for it, because he knows that she's cheating on him. So he figures, yeah, he can agree to pay for the wedding. It's probably not going to happen anyway. Okay, so that's one vote for yes.
One vote for yes. So what does the other half of the Familia Noah think? Alan, do you think that Moonstruck stands the test of time?
I really was struggling with a lot of this movie because I just wasn't sure what was supposed to be funny and what wasn't supposed to be funny. And yes, this movie is considered a comedy. It was nominated for a ton of Golden Globes as a comedy. But I think the things that I thought were bordering on satire, like basically everything Nicolas Cage says, is not supposed to be funny. James, along those lines, did you see that Will Ferrell IFC show, The Spoils of Babylon? And then there was a sequel, The Spoils Before Dying?
No, I did not.
That was basically a parody of made-for-TV miniseries, like I guess from the 80s and 90s. But it was all of these really funny comedic actors doing these overly dramatized, soapy kind of roles. And the acting was so bad, but on purpose, that it was really, really funny. This movie kind of made me think of that, but I don't think that's what it was going for. I think this movie was supposed to be serious and not borderline parody. So that I didn't love. And I also just didn't like the fact that the movie was really, really in your face with a lot of its themes. You know, listeners of the podcast know I appreciate when movies have a little bit of subtlety. There is nothing subtle about this movie. They go on and on about the moon. They go on and on about luck. When Chrissy, the woman at the bakery who you mentioned earlier, James, when, you know, he's saying, Chrissy, get me the knife. After he goes on that whole monologue, Chrissy says, oh, I love him, but I cannot tell him that I love him. And I never will tell him because he is too hurt. She's just like explaining her whole character in just like pure exposition. There's a scene when Loretta's walking home after she slept with Ronnie where she is literally kicking a can down the road. I mean, that's just like blatant, you know, symbolism.
I was kind of mesmerized by that, though. I just wanted to see her kick the can one more time. One more time.
I was like, oh my God, we get it. She's kicking the can down the road, literally and metaphorically. Okay. I didn't love any of it. You know, a couple of jokes were funny along the way, but by and large, I just could not get into this movie. And I'm going to say that no, it does not stand the test of time. So the Noahs are split. James, which one of us do you agree with?
You know, I found a lot of things in this film charming. I think the supporting cast, I think it kind of reminded me of the movie The Nutty Professor, where the family scenes are great. I love these side characters. But I just didn't quite get why this was so acclaimed. I thought, am I missing something? And I'm totally open to, I just didn't get parts of it. I thought there were parts of this that I think that was supposed to be funny. Or did I miss that they didn't even talk about the dead mother? How come no one cares about a dead mother in this film? All I'm saying, it just didn't resonate to me. I didn't really connect to the film. I thought that everyone acted fine. Nicolas Cage, I'm going to say, I'm not sure if he was miscast or if I just didn't get the character of Ronnie. Is he supposed to be crazy? Because if he's supposed to be totally crazy, then sure, Nicolas Cage is perfectly fine in this. But I didn't really get the chemistry between them. I didn't really see much chemistry between Cher and Nicolas Cage. I thought it was very cute. I just unfortunately didn't pick up the classicness of it. And I'm going to have to say that I don't think this film is an amazing film. It's got a lot of charm to it at parts, but I kind of thought parts of it were just boring. I thought it was slower than I wanted it to be. And so for me, no, this film does not stand the test of time.
Sorry, Courtney, you're on your own.
That's an oof.
As our son would say. But you know what? That's okay, because when the moon hits your eyes like a big pizza pie, that's amore. And when something, 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 pasta fazool, that's also amore.
One thing about this film is I feel like had I grown up on this film, I really think this might have some more nostalgic pull. I kind of wish I had seen this film a few times with my family growing up.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was one of those like Sunday afternoon in the movies type things.
I could picture
that. And that's
that.
Maybe where I first saw it.
I could see it as like an easy movie to just kind of watch, you know. I see the appeal. We had a socially distanced get together with some family members the other day, and we were talking about this movie, and my stepdad was like, oh, it's so funny. I'm like, but is it all supposed to be funny? And he's like, yeah, it's very funny. I'm like, even the part when Nicolas Cage is like screaming about how he lost his hand, is that supposed to be funny? And he's like, I don't think so. I'm like, yeah, I don't think so either. But that's going to do it for us this week. Courtney, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime. You're welcome anytime. You know that. Next week, we're going to be doing another Cher movie, but not a movie with the actor / singer Cher. We're going to be talking about Clueless. Remember Cher? That's Alicia Silverstone's character.
Yep.
Yeah, see? That was clever. That was a good segue.
I think she's named after Cher.
I would assume so.
Yeah, because it's like mid-90s and Cher was huge in the mid-70s and she's like 16 in the film.
Right, it makes sense. So yeah, we're going to talk about Clueless for its 25th anniversary. In the meantime, you know where we are. We're on all the podcast places. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and SoundCloud and Stitcher and everywhere. Like us, subscribe, rate, review, all of the things, and talk to us at Test of Time Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
If you also put a letter in the mail and it just says Test of Time Podcast with a stamp, it will make it to us.
No, it won't.
Well, it works for the White House, so I assume it'll work for us.
The U.S. Postal Service has enough problems. Don't burden them. We'll see you next time, everybody.
Bye.